Hello, how are you?
Fine, dear.
Good.
How are you, Ralph?
Alex?
Good.
I was sad to see for you.
Thank you. Hi, good morning, everyone. Good afternoon, everyone. And we're looking today at one of the very, very mysterious rituals in the Torah, the most mysterious of all. It is called Chok. Chok, the word Chok, refers to commandments for which we don't understand the reason. Mishpat are the rules that are logical to us. Don't kill, don't steal, we would figure that out on our own. Although some people have a hard time even getting that. But the Chok is that which is inexplicable. That doesn't mean it's without sense, but it means the ultimate meaning is something that is beyond us. And this is the ritual of what is called the Parah Aduma, the red heifer. And this is a ritual in which the Torah says, you gotta locate a red cow. Now this doesn't mean fire engine red, there's no such thing. But you know, the typical orange brown that cows have, but it has to be 100%, so the color is not that uncommon. But it has to be 100%, or at least 99.999%. It can have up to one black hair, but everything else has to be totally red. That cow is slaughtered, it is burnt into ashes, and the ashes are mixed with spring water from the gushing spring. And whenever a Jew has become tamei, ritually impure by contact with the dead, the ritual of purification is on day three, meaning the third day, meaning if I was in a cemetery on Sunday, so Tuesday is day three, on Tuesday, and on day seven, counting from my encounter with the mace, I am sprinkled with that mixture of water and ashes. On day seven, I then go to a mikveh, and then I am considered to be ritually pure. I cannot enter the temple until I've undergone this ritual of purification. That is why, technically, you know, this is why most Orthodox Jews do not go on the Temple Mount. You'll notice we don't go on the Temple Mount. We only go up to the Western Wall. We do not go beyond the Western Wall. The reason is because beyond the Western Wall is the courtyard of the temple, and anyone that's ever become impure by contact with the dead cannot enter the sacred area until they've undergone the ritual of purification. And since we don't have that ritual of purification, we are permanently tamei until the Mashiach comes. And as a result, that's why we don't enter. Okay, that is exactly why a religious Jew does not enter the Temple Mount, because every one of us is considered to be ritually tamei because we've been in a cemetery, a funeral, or whatever it is. Now, this is called the ritual of the Parah Aduma. Every once in a while, people claim to have discovered a red heifer, and they think that means Mashiach is coming. In fact, there is one in a undisclosed location near Lakewood, New Jersey, in which a farmer has the Parah Aduma. It's a Christian farmer, and they're not revealing the location, so there shouldn't be tourists that might do something, and the like. And many people think that's a sign that the Mashiach is coming, and all of that. But you know, who knows? There is a certain catch-22 involved, because in order to prepare the Parah Aduma, you have to be ritually pure yourself. So in the olden days, the way it worked was, we would use the remaining ashes. When we needed a new Parah Aduma, we would use the remaining ashes to purify the Kohanim, who would then prepare the new Parah Aduma. But now we have a catch-22. Let's say that we have a Parah Aduma, but we have no way of preparing it because nobody is ritually pure until they've been sprinkled with those ashes, but there are no ashes to be sprinkled on somebody. So how are we going to do this ritual when the time comes? The short answer is that Elijah the prophet, who is a Kohen, will come back with a jar of the last Parah Aduma, and will sprinkle it on a select number of Kohanim, who will then be able to perform the ritual on the new cow, and then we could be purified. Now, I don't want to get into the technical details too much, but I just want to point out that, number one, the Parah Aduma was a very, very rare animal for a lot of reasons. Not so much the color, but the idea of the 100%. It's very difficult to have a cow that is literally 100% with no more than one black feature. But number two, there are a lot of ways that this cow could become disqualified for being used for this ritual. If, for example, the cow had a blemish, like a broken leg, or even a serious scratch, no good. If somebody did work with the cow, you used it to draw a plow. No good. Even if you simply put your hand on it, you leaned it, you leaned your weight on it, maybe no good. So this cow had to be watched very, very carefully to be sure that it did not become disqualified. If the cow had sexual relations, so to speak, if it mated with a bull, that would disqualify it. Right? So one had to be very, very careful. Because of this, the Parah Adumah commanded a great deal of money, whether it was from a Jewish owner or a non-Jewish owner. You may recall the very, very famous story of a non-Jewish man who lived in Ashkelon, and he was considered to be the model of what it means to honor your parents. And the Gemara tells us a story that one time he had a very precious jewel, and that jewel was needed in the Beit HaMikdash for the Kohen's vestments. And the key to the jewelry box was under his father's pillow, and his father was asleep. And he forfeited the sale, which could have been thousands and thousands of shkolim, because he didn't want to wake his father from asleep. This is how much he honored his dad. Now, I have a little bit of a kasha on this. I mean, let's imagine somebody offered you $6 million for something, but you didn't want to wake up your father. When dad wakes up, you know, an hour or two later, is dad going to be happy or unhappy? Dad, you idiot! Why didn't you wake me up? $6 million! It's a good question, really. Meaning, halachically, it's not at all clear that you let your father sleep. I mean, you got to make a judgment. What would dad want more? But be it as it may, we're not necessarily saying, see, this is an important subtlety, we're not necessarily saying that the non-Jew made the right decision. Maybe he made the wrong decision. But we're saying that his motivations were that he had such honor for his father that he was willing to give up $6 million. Okay. But the Talmud goes on and says that in reward for the honor that he showed his father, the next year he got a parah adumah in his flock that he was able to sell for a lot of money to the temple. And they wanted to give him more money than they were going to pay him last year. And his response was, nope, just give me what I would have gotten on the deal last year. I don't have to get more money on that. So parah adumah was quite an expensive proposition. Another thing that's so interesting is, if you think about this, the ashes of the parah adumah were distributed throughout Israel. They were like regional purification offices. So you didn't have to go to Jerusalem to get sprinkled. You could do it in Tzfat, in Haifa, whatever it would be. But if you think about how many people needed this sprinkling in the course of the year, the halacha is that normally if you're impure, that's fine. You don't have to do anything about it. But if you want to go to the temple, you want to go to the three pilgrimage festivals, you have to be pure. So every single year, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Jews needed to go through this purification ritual at least three times a year. So you're talking about something that was used by millions of people over a period of around 1800 years, if you calculate the years of availability. And yet we have a tradition that for the entire period of the Parah Adumah ritual, only 10 cows were used, the ashes of 10 cows. And in fact, number 10 was not totally used up, and that's going to be coming back when Eliyahu HaNavi comes. Think about that. I mean, okay, a cow is not a small animal, but you know, however big it is, you mix the ashes with spring water and you sprinkle it on millions of people, or at least, depending on the years, hundreds of thousands of people over a 1600 to 1800 year period. That would seem to use up a lot more ashes than you'd get out of 9 or 10 cows. So really, the Talmud itself tells me that this was one of the divine miracles, that there was enough to go around, that logically it should not have remained that way. Okay. Yeah.
What about going to the mikveh? What's the difference between the mikveh?
Okay, very, very different. In truth, to be purified from the tomei of dead bodies, you need both rituals. You need the sprinkling of the water. And by the way, that's where the Catholics got the holy water ritual. It was borrowed, just like baptism. Baptism was borrowed from mikveh, and the holy water sprinkling was borrowed from parah adumah. So when people say, hey, this sounds Christian, I mean, it's the opposite. When the Christians do it, it sounds Jewish. It's not, you know, it was in the Torah just like the Pope's yarmulke, the Cardinal's yarmulke, obviously is the kippah, right? That's our thing. Okay, now the thing is, you need both rituals. You need the ritual of sprinkling, and that's not immersion, that's simply a drop. A little drop hits you. That's enough. And then you need total body immersion. Now it's interesting, for other types of impurity, if you touch dead animals, or you have a seminal emission, or a woman is menstruates, all you need is mikvah. You don't need the ashes of the parah aduma. It is only for contact with dead bodies that you need the parah aduma. It's unique to tumat meis. Okay.
Not just for the kohen, for every Jew.
Every Jew. Now, but here's my point. Every Jew doesn't always have to be pure. In other words, if I went to a cemetery, but if I want to go to the temple, I want to go for the three pilgrimage festivals, I do have to be pure, and then I would have to undergo. So every Jew had to undergo this ritual at least three times a year, unless they avoided any cemeteries for that entire time. And keep in mind, in the olden days, it probably was more common for people to become tameh because people would die at home. In other words, death, unfortunately, was perhaps a more common occurrence in private places than it is today. Today, most people die in hospitals or nursing homes or the like, but for most of history, people would die at home. And as a result, keep in mind that the tumah, the impurity you get by contact with the dead, is not only if I touch a corpse, but if I'm in the same building as a corpse, I become ritually impure. If I pass under a tree that covers both the grave and me, that's called a common tent, I become ritually impure. Right? The notion of tumah is not only direct physical contact with the corpse, that's comparatively rare for most people, but simply being in the same building with a corpse. That is why anyone who walks into a hospital, if the morgue is located in the hospital, might become ritually impure. Yeah.
Is that a dead body then?
Say again?
Is that a dead body we're talking about?
Yeah, we're talking about dead body, yeah. So I'm then, talking about how you become tameh when you're in contact.
What about then, and you have a lot of people going to a funeral, for example.
Yeah.
They're coming into direct contact with the dead body.
That's correct. So everyone is tameh. But let me point out that there is no, unless you're a kohen, and a kohen does not go to funerals except for close relatives, there is no avera in becoming tameh. Uh-huh. Yeah, you become tameh. It's not a sin. But the only thing is, if I want to go to the temple, I have to go through the ritual of purification. So there's no sin in becoming tameh. In fact, to go to a funeral is a mitzvah. Okay, so be sure you understand this. We are not talking about any avera that somebody's committing, but we're simply saying, if you are in a state of impurity, you have to undergo purification rituals. Now, this is very mysterious, kind of inexplicable. Why a red cow and all of these laws? But now I'm going to add to the inexplicability of this phenomenon. On one hand, the ashes of the parah aduma are a vehicle of purity and release from the restrictions of tumah. On the other hand, there's another rule that says every single person who handles the ashes becomes ritually tameh. So, you were in a cemetery. You want to go to Jerusalem and visit the temple. So you go to a kohen. It doesn't have to be in Jerusalem. It could be in Sfat. It could be anywhere. The kohen sprinkles you with a mixture of the ashes and the water on day 3. And then on day 7, so you have 4 days in between, you go to the mikveh. That night you're pure. Next day you can go to Jerusalem. Great. You're pure. You're fine. But I, who was handling those ashes, I have made myself ritually impure. Now, you might think, does this create the problem of infinite regression in which it's impossible to get everybody pure? Because I make you pure, I become impure, so I have to get sprinkled by the ashes of the parah aduma, so I become pure and he becomes impure, so he gets sprinkled by somebody else who then becomes impure. So you're always going to have one guy at the end of the cycle.
Impure.
Yeah, the answer is that's not true. That's logically not true. And the reason is, because although the people who handle the ashes become ritually impure, but since they didn't become impure by contact with the dead body, they don't need the ashes. They just have to go to the mikveh. In other words, The cycle ends, they just go to the mikveh, they don't need to be sprinkled by anybody else. So I sprinkle you, I become tamei, I go to the mikveh, I'm fine.
They just told me because they touched the dead animal.
Huh?
They just told me because they touched the dead animal.
No, no, well, not even that, that's a good point. And the reason is that the parah aduma is shechted. If an animal dies because it was shechted, it conveys no tumah. Otherwise, every time you eat meat,
it's a different cat, it's a different type of cat.
Not because of that. It was shechted. Any animal that undergoes ritual shechita is not tamei. Otherwise, every time you eat meat, you become tamei. No. They don't. The paraduma they did not eat. No. It was burnt into ashes. They did not eat the paraduma.
Carbonus
they eat. That's right. They don't.
They would be impure.
Right. That's correct.
Yeah.
The answer is this rule that dead animals convey tumah is only if it died naturally or was killed without the halachic process of shechita. If it underwent the halachic process of shechita, there is no tumah. There is no tumah at all. That's one reason. The other reason is that anything that is reduced to ash no longer conveys tumah. Unfortunately, I don't know if any of you ever visited Poland or the concentration camps in Poland, but if you've been to Auschwitz and the like, to this very day, more than 70 years after the end, almost 80 years after World War II, there will occasionally be, ashes around there that could be identified as the ashes of concentration camp victims, Jews who were burnt in the ovens. And the question becomes, if I'm a Kohen is not allowed to come in contact with the dead, can a Kohen go there? And our short answer is, unfortunately, that once a body has been burnt into ash, it is no longer considered to be a human corpse in terms of tumah. So that would be another reason why the parah adumah. So you can, yeah. Same thing with you. And now with the World Trade Center, there was another issue. There you may actually have occasional human remains and the like. And there's all sorts of questions. Tumah can apply to anybody, but the prohibition against contact with the dead is only a Kohen. So if you're a Kohen, you got to be concerned. You walk into museums like the Smithsonian. There might be American Indian, or Native American, we call them now, remains in display cases. And there might be all sorts of things you might not think about. In fact, now they have a traveling exhibit that's a little macabre, in which they show different skeletons in formaldehyde, muscle tissue and the like. Well, if you're a Kohen, there's a real problem. Can you walk into those exhibits and the like? So one needs to check this out if you are a Kohen and the like. Okay. So Chazal encapsulate Parah Adumah as the epitome of a paradox. And the paradox is that it purifies those who are tamei, and it contaminates those who are tahor, who are pure. And that's a paradox. How can the same thing do two opposite things? The very thing that releases me from impurity then becomes a source of impurity. And that is one of the reasons why it is called chok. Chok means the inexplicable, the unexplainable, the idea of paradox, the idea of self-contradiction within the very idea. But here I want to point out that this was considered to be so mysterious that even King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, who is considered to be the wisest of all people, even Shlomo HaMelech says he didn't get Parah Adumah. When he came to Parah Adumah, he said, I am stuck. This I cannot explain. Strangely enough, there is one person that our sages identified who understood the mystery of Parah Adumah, and this is a little bizarre, and that is our friend Korach of last week. Korach was the guy that the ground opened up and swallowed. It said, he figured out Parah Adumah. Of all the people who would figure out Parah Adumah, Korach got the secret. But he took it with him to the grave, so to speak. He died before he was able to teach it in any particular way. But that just shows you, Korach was not just a troublemaker. He must have been a very, very wise, not in the moral sense, but intellectually, he must have been very, very great in terms of what he understood. But now, I want to go back to an interesting teaching. Rashi brings a teaching from a rabbi who's not in the Gemara, he's after the Gemara, Rav Moshe Hadarshan. Rav Moshe Hadarshan means Rabbi Moshe the preacher. And he connects the ritual of Parah Adumah to being an atonement over the golden calf. Right? The Jewish people committed this sin of worshipping the golden calf. And he says the analogy is like this. A calf, of course, is the baby of a cow, right? So he says, if a baby messes up, right, a baby, whatever it is, messes up, vomits, or whatever, so mom has to clean up after the baby's mess. So the ritual of Parah Adumah is that the mother, which is the cow, comes and atones over the sin of the child that we committed with the child, right? So there's a certain association that Parah Adumah is an atonement for the sin of the golden calf, Chet HaEgel. The question is, how does it atone? I mean, what exactly does Parah Adumah do that's an atonement? So in the remainder of my time here, I want to give you two explanations that in what particular way can the very strange ritual of Parah Adumah be an atonement or a forgiveness for the sin of the golden calf. Okay, explanation number one is the following. Let's go back a little bit. What exactly was the sin of the golden calf? It's very, very clear that the Jewish people did not believe that this golden calf, which they had just created, right? The men had thrown their jewelry into the fire, and a golden calf emerged. They know this was not the God that created heaven and earth. They know this was not the God that took them out of Egypt. They know that because they just made it. And in fact, if you recall, the reason why they made the golden calf is Moses was at Mount Sinai. He was there for 40 days. He was supposed to come down. He didn't come down because they miscalculated the time. And they figured, they panicked. Moses is not here. We're in big trouble. Let us make a God who will take care of us. Now, it's very clear. By the way, what day was that? That's the day that's coming up this month. The 17th of Tammuz was the day that Moses came down from the mountain. He saw the golden calf, and he smashed the tablets. Right? That's why. That's the main reason why that's in 2 weeks. That's going to be a fast day. That was the day that the Luchot, the tablets, were smashed. So it's very, very clear that they didn't look at the Egel as a substitute for God. They looked at the Egel as a substitute for Moses. And they didn't think Moses was a god because they call him Moses the man. And the explanation that the Kuzari and the Ramban all give to this point is that the Jewish people believed in a supreme God that created heaven and earth. But they thought they needed a spiritual intermediary to channel God's divinity. They thought they were not worthy of a direct face-to-face connection. And they looked at Moses as the intermediary. And when that intermediary is not present, they want to do spiritual channeling through an object that they thought would bring God's energy into the world. So their sin was that one of over-reliance on rationality, in the sense that they thought that we as physical beings can only connect to God in a physical media and not through a spiritual media, because we are not totally spiritual, and therefore we need physicality, because our minds relate only to the concrete and not to the abstract. We can connect only to something that we can see with our senses and not to something that is incorporeal or non-corporeal. And therefore, if the sin of the golden calf was that they needed to have a rationalistic conception of God that they could embrace with their senses, the atonement is to do something that's totally irrational. Meaning, when your sin derives from rationality, the atonement is to move in the opposite direction. So the atonement of the sin of the golden calf lies precisely in the fact that the ego makes, that the Parah Adumah makes no sense. Meaning, you tried to make a religion that made sense to you. The way you atone for that Avera is by doing something that makes no sense to you. And in that way, you have total submission to God. That's one idea of how it undoes the Chedo Ego. But there is a deeper idea as well. that the Cheta Egel was not only a sin in the sense of over-rationality, but it was a sin in not recognizing our own greatness. Maimonides writes that the historical origin of paganism actually stemmed from an excess of humility within a person. And that is, a person felt he was not worthy of having a relationship with God. And the same way that a person might say that I'm not going to talk to the president, I'll talk to a secretary or an undersecretary or my local congressman, because who am I to be able to connect to the president? So too, the original pagans thought, we are not worthy enough of having a connection with the Almighty. We will work through his intermediaries and his subsidiary forces. And there are different angels, just like the Department of State in the United States. There's the Undersecretary of State for South America and the Undersecretary of State for Europe, etc. So we will deal with the undersecretaries. But it came from humility. Now later, paganism degenerated. It did degenerate into a denial of one God. But in its inception, it came from a sense of being so overwhelmed with the glory of the glory and grandeur of God that I am not deserving of a relationship with God. It came from humility. It came from a lack of belief in yourself, a lack of belief in your worthiness, and that resulted in the golden calf. So in a sense, the sin of the golden calf was not a lack of faith in God as much as it was a lack of faith in yourself, in your worthiness to have a direct relationship to God. And that is why you turn to an intermediary. Everyone understands that idea, that I am not worthy of connecting to God. I must deal with the lower forces, because I am not good enough. I am not worthy enough. In that sense, Para Aduma is an interesting connective, because let's go back to the idea of why the Para Aduma is a ritual of purification. Death came into the world because of the sin of Adam and Eve in eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge, which, by the way, was absolutely not an apple. It may have been many things. Some say it was the grape of the vine. Some say it was wheat. Some say it was an esrog. Some say it was a fig. Nobody says it was an apple. So the apple is the one thing that there is no reference that it was. But what did the snake do to entice Adam and Eve to eat the fruit? So the Chumash says, the snake said, if you eat this fruit, you will be like God, master and knower of good and evil. Remember the Matrix, when they give them, they have two pills, the red pill and the blue pill. Take that, I don't remember anymore. The blue pill will what? Make you this and that. The red pill, you'll go back to normal life. So imagine somebody gives you a God pill. Take this pill, whatever that means, and you will be like God. Wow. Ultimate ego trip. So what caused man's fall was the incessant desire for kavod, for honor, for glory, for ego gratification. It was ego and arrogance and hubris that brought death into the world, because not so much as a punishment, but as an ultimate reminder that man is not God. Because in many, many ways, we are godlike. We are in the image of God. That does not refer to physicality. God does not have a physical form. But it refers to intelligence, autonomy, free will. We have many divine attributes. We can destroy, we can create all sorts of things. Although you know the joke about, we still have not created, we have not been able to create life from inorganic matter. But they say some great scientist took a bunch of dirt and he zapped it with chemicals and electricity and all sorts of things. And he finally got living life. He created life. So he shouts out to God, God, I have done everything you've done. I have broken the last frontier. I have created life. I am God. So God says to him, next time get your own dirt. Meaning to say, even then, you know, you had to take something that God created. Okay. But be it as it may, in many, many ways, we are godly. And that's a wonderful thing. That's why Judaism does not say be passive in the world. Judaism does not say if there's malaria or illness in the world, let it happen. We drain the swamps. We advance medical technology. We create. We build. Faith is not passivity. Faith is not quiescence. Faith is not saying God will take care of everything. Faith is knowing that God has made us a partner in the endeavors that need to be done. Faith is empowering. It takes initiative. But there's always a risk of hubris, arrogance, gaiva. And that is why God put death in the world as the ultimate reminder that as great as you may be, as godly as you may be, there is a chasm, there is a gap between created and creator that can never be bridged. And that is why death came into the world, as the ultimate reminder that I am not God. I may convince myself that I'm God, but I'm going to die someday. I'm not God. That is why, if death comes into the world by arrogance, we become liberated from the impurity of death by humility. Now, I'm not going to explain every little detail of the red heifer, but suffice it to say, it does involve putting ashes on me. Right? Ashes are the ultimate symbol of humility and submission. I am like dust and ashes. I become impure by contact with death, which came into the world because of arrogance and pride and ego. I become liberated from death by making myself ashes, by connecting myself to ashes. I become reborn and recreated by humility, modesty, surrender. No, the Greek myth of the phoenix bird, which actually there's a very similar story in our Medrash, I shouldn't really call it a Greek myth, is this bird gets burnt into ashes, and out of the ashes it arises. That's a very profound teaching. What it's saying is, we achieve life by kind of getting rid of our ego, getting rid of our arrogance. That we think that humility basically means I destroy myself. But sometimes it's in the very process in which I give up the ego, that I become reborn to a higher spiritual being. That is what Paraduma. Paraduma is, in a sense, a reenactment of this phoenix type of idea, that I become impure with death because of arrogance and gaiva. I become liberated from death with the rituals of modesty and submission. Mikvah, by the way, is the same thing. It's been pointed out in many ways that immersion in a mikvah, which you needed both. You both needed the sprinkling and the mikvah. Mikvah is said to be a womb ceremony, because when a baby in the womb is surrounded by water, it's breathing through the umbilical cord, right? And you know, the nostrils are closed. The baby is in fluid. In fact, there's actually a method of natural childbirth where babies are born underwater. It's supposed to relax them, because that's the environment that they're used to. And therefore, what is mikveh? Mikveh is killing off, and of course, water for an adult is a medium that will kill you. I put myself underwater. I'm putting myself in an environment that is lethal if I stay too long. So what are you really doing, in a way? You're killing off the old self, and you're being reborn as a new person. That's why mikveh is a purification ritual, because you're killing off the old identity that is filled with arrogance and false pride and ego, to be born like a new baby who comes into the world without that ego, without those preconceptions. Right? So in a sense, you find yourself by losing yourself. Because when you're filled with egotism, you're kind of stuck. You can't move. You can't take criticism. You can't take new ideas. You can't take challenges to the way you're living life. When I don't have an ego, I'm open to all sorts of possibilities. If I could quote, not a Torah source, Ronald Reagan once said, again, I'm not endorsing any conservative or liberal politics at all, I'm just, it's a nice quote. He once said that there is no end to the good that we could accomplish in the world if we didn't care who got the credit for things. If we could put our egos aside, work together, how much could be done? An amazing thing. So again, to repeat the basic point, death comes into the world from arrogance. We become liberated from death through humility. But here is the rub. Just like physicists say, there is matter and antimatter. I'm going to make two statements about humility. Humility is the most important quality that a human being can have. It makes him open to change, open to growth. It gives him the ability to learn and progress in life, the ability to love and the ability to forgive. Real important. Statement number two, it is the most destructive quality a person can have. It's the worst thing to have. How could that be? I just contradicted him. I said it's the most important thing to have, and it's the worst thing. Because there are two types of humilities. There is the humility which denies my worth, denies my value. I look at myself as garbage. I look at myself as worthless. That is not a spiritual virtue. That is very, very destructive. Because if a person looks at himself as worthless and not having spiritual value, then they will never have the energy to accomplish. They will always think, why does God care if I daven or I learn, I do mitzvahs, I give charity? Who am I? I am a zero. That's the humility of self-degradation. That is the humility of not knowing your value, not knowing your mission. That is destructive. That is counterproductive. Then there's the other humility, that instead of paralyzing you, there's the humility of knowing your worth, knowing your value, identifying your strengths, capitalizing on your strengths, but knowing that they're gifts from God and not using them as a source of arrogance. So humility can be a life-transforming positive attribute when taken in the right way, and humility can be very, very destructive if it leads to depression, despair, and a sense of worthlessness in your life. One might suggest that that is in part the mystery of Parah Adumah. Like we said, the mystery is paradox. How can the ashes purify and at the same time create impurity? Answer, if ashes are a symbol of humility and self-abnegation, the very type of midah that can liberate me from my ego, if taken in the wrong direction, can also destroy me. And therefore, Parah Adumah is conveying the subtlety that sometimes the very things that are most positive in life, if taken the wrong way and to an extreme, can turn into the negative. And this is how it atones for the golden calf. Because the golden calf was exactly an example of an excessive humility that went in a destructive way, as they thought they were not worthy of connecting with God. I atone for the golden calf by engaging in a ritual that embodies the lesson and the idea that good things taken in the wrong direction can be destructive. And therefore, it exactly counteracts the sin of the golden calf. So this is the paradox that a Jew has to live with. There is a famous teaching, it's not in the Gemara, but it's by a great Hasidic Rebbe, that a Jew has to have two ideas in his pocket at all times. Idea number one, I am dust and ashes, I am a nothing. Idea number two, because of me, the world was created. What does that mean? The Mishnah says that when God created the world in 6 days, whatever the 6 days are, He created many elephants and many tigers and many dogs and many cats and many cows. But he only created one man and one woman. And even there we're uncertain, was it man, woman together, or first man and then woman? But only one human being, or at least one man. Why didn't God create many, many men? Why only one human being? Answer: so that each person should recognize that God created this universe for me. And who's the me? Every one of us. That this whole structure is worthy for one human life. Right? So, simultaneously, right, Judaism loves paradoxes. Simultaneously with the idea that I'm nothing, I have to be humble, I have to be aware of my limitations, I also have to be aware of my greatness. So the ashes that purify can be the ashes that contaminate when they're taken in the wrong way. And it's been well said that a person who is not aware of their faults is a fool. If I think I'm perfect, I'm just crazy. But if a person is not aware of their greatness, that is a tragedy, because I will never be able to accomplish my mission in life if I don't honestly recognize the gifts and the talents that Hashem gave us. And every person has a different set of gifts and talents. You know, we sometimes look at other people and we say, gee, I wish I could do that, I wish I could be that. That's fine. But sometimes in looking at what other people do, we fail to notice that which is good within us, right? So that's kind of the message of the paradox of the Paraduma. So I feel a little guilty saying this, because we're told the Paraduma has no explanation. I just gave you a little of an explanation, right? So obviously this is a very incomplete explanation. All I can tell you is if King Solomon didn't get it, I certainly didn't get it. But at least it's a certain perspective, a partial perspective that we can take on life. And I hope it's, you know, it has a practical lesson that we can apply as well, because everything in the Torah ultimately has to turn into a lesson that we can take into our lives. Although much of it is theoretical, much of it doesn't apply today in a literal halachic sense, but spiritually there are going to be lessons that are still relevant. So God willing, we should all be aware both of our need for humility, but our need to recognize our strengths, and in that way we will accomplish what our life's mission is. So have a Shabbat Shalom. Yep.